Good morning, everyone. Good evening, good afternoon, whenever you're watching this episode, and welcome to Goddess Talks on the Goddess Project podcast. I'm very excited to bring another Goddess Talks episode to you this season three, and there's a bunch more coming that I'm really excited to share with you. So, what if everything you thought you knew about the Minotaur was wrong? What if this legendary beast, half man, half bull, wasn't a monster at all, but a symbol of something far older and far more sacred? For those of you who don't know me, I'm Dr. Carla Ionescu, and in this episode of Goddess Talks, I sit down with Laura Perry, a leading expert in Minoan spirituality, to unravel the truth behind the bull, the labyrinth, and the gods of ancient Crete. Now, the Minoans, the Bronze Age civilization that thrived on Crete, left behind a rich and complex mythology that has been overshadowed by Greek retellings. But who were their gods, and how do they connect to the later pantheon of the Olympus, of the Olympians? Whew, this morning, words are hard. Now, one of the biggest surprises in mine and Laura's conversation today is Dionysus. We often think of him as the Greek god of wine, revelry, chaos, but his roots go much, much deeper. So was Dionysus really a Minoan god? Was he connected to the sacred bull long before the Greeks reshaped his mythology? This has been my question for a very long time. And so did the Mycenaeans adapt and transform Minoan deities? Was the Minoan pantheon lost? Did it survive later on in disguise within the later Greek mythology? We're going to ask all these questions. I'm going to ask all these questions because I have all these questions for Laura Perry. And we had a really wonderful, wonderful discussion. So join me to discuss all of this. Laura Perry is an author, an artist, a spiritual practitioner who has spent years researching and reconstructing Minoan religion and spirituality. She is the creator of Ariadne's Tribe, which you can find on Facebook, which is a modern community dedicated to reviving Minoan spiritual traditions. She's also an author of multiple books, including Tales from the Labyrinth. And her upcoming release, which I'm very, very excited about, is called Pantheons, the Minoans. You can pre-order down in the description, and there's much more about Laura's website. So this is a conversation you don't want to miss. We're going to piece together ancient clues and uncover this lost religious traditions of the Minoans. And this might change the way you not just see the Minotaur, but the entire Greek pantheon. So join us. Let's go. Okay. Woohoo. All right. So it is wonderful to have you here again on Goddess Talks on the Goddess Project podcast. So welcome, welcome, Laura Perry.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be back.
Yay. Last time we talked a lot about Minoan culture, but I thought that we will talk a lot about Minoan culture as well, but I thought that we could start with, so I wanted to tell you the story, okay, just a brief story about Dionysus and the Minotaur, or the bull. And you tell me about the Cretan research that kind of comes up with that, because where do I start? It feels so typical to say I have a deep relationship with Crete. Don't you find that you hear this a lot?
Yeah.
I find sometimes that it's starting to sound a bit cliche, but also I'm very happy that lots of people have a deep relationship with Crete. You know. I was talking to Sarita Deste a little while ago, and I said to her, I don't know if you can understand this, but when I'm on that island, I feel like the mountains are my brothers. That's like, it feels like I'm nestled in family. I don't understand what this means, you know? And so we all love Crete. Lots of women go to Crete, lots of stuff going on around Crete. It's wonderful. I'm not a big fan of male gods, as you might know, and so I don't normally pay attention to them at all. But I was in Spain for a little while, and the bull, of course, the bull of Spain is everywhere, and this bull kept showing up. Okay, I thought my son is a Taurus. Maybe I'll get him a shirt. I don't know. The bull everywhere in Spain. Okay. And then that evening, I watched this episode again. I think it was one of Sarita's published writers who was talking about Dionysus and had this image of the bull beside him. And she had said, well, Dionysus is worshipped as the bull, or was worshipped as the bull in Crete. And like academically, I knew that. But when I saw that thing come together, I went, holy crap. And then I don't know how to explain this, Laura, because now this is starting to sound less academic and totally spiritual. I felt like the God was like gonna hang out with me for the weekend. I knew, so I had a couple of things
Nice.
happening. And I said to myself, tomorrow this thing's gonna work because I know he's a trick, because I always see him as a bit of a trickster figure, you know? I'm like, I know he's messing with me. And then the next day, this thing came. And then I went to this museum. And of course, the centerpiece was this Dionysian bronze. And I thought, and then the guide that we were with was like, look at the bull, look at the bull, look at the bull. And I'm like, okay. And there was like this very clear hangout that he was doing, which sounds so silly, but anyway, I'm gonna share it. And then he was gone, after a few days. And so I thought of you. When I saw Crete and the bull, I was like, if anybody can help me out, other than academic stuff that you can find, of course, but I thought I would love to talk to Laura about the bull. I know we talked about the Minotaur before, but just the bull as not this monstrous figure, in Crete, and any of the other gods, or maybe, how what you think or what your research has brought up about Dionysus and all of that. So that's a big question, but I don't know. You may start wherever you like. What do you think? I don't know.
Okay, so how about we start by painting the background, the setting for what we're going to be talking about. Okay, so time is an important aspect of mythology. Okay. Humans have lived in many different eras, and the deities exist along with us in all of those eras, but we change and they change from one time period to another. And also the way they appear to us and the attributes that we connect with them also change as our cultures interact with each other for better or for worse. So, for instance, if you're looking just at Dionysus, the deity who we call Dionysus and whose name actually appears in the Linear B tablets, so we know for sure that he's that old. He is one kind of deity in Minoan Crete during the Bronze Age. And then when you move past the Late Bronze Age collapse and into the Iron Age, so what we consider like classical antiquity, then Dionysus is syncretized with a similar ecstatic deity from Phrygia called Sabazios. And so when we look at Dionysus in the classical era, it's that syncretic deity. And so he has a new and additional set of characteristics then that he did not have back in Minoan Crete. So the era during which you connect with a deity will change your experience of the deity because they are different. It's just like you're not the same now as you were when you were a teenager, right?
Love that. I love that.
Okay.
Okay.
So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and total makes sense, in fact. And now I'll have to think a bit about Artemis around that. I think that has clicked a few things into place for me, Laura. And maybe, I mean, it's totally logical. It's just maybe not the way we think about it sometimes.
Yeah, so I should I'd love to talk with you about Artemis sometime because one of our board members is a dance ethnographer, and her research suggests that prior to the Iron Age, Artemis was originally a sun goddess.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
I love that. Yes, I love that. I love that. Because for me, even with Artemis and perhaps even with Dionysus, I mean, Sometimes I feel like I'm very, 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 very Artemis centered. So I don't allow a lot of the other deities into my space in some ways. Dionysus, like I said, sort of forces his way in every now and then. I don't know why. I think it's his fluidity. It
Have you
allows.
considered the possibility that he just likes you?
No, I was raised Catholic. If there isn't suffering involved, Lord. Perhaps. I mean, so now I hadn't really, I thought about Ariadne a lot because a long time ago I had this very powerful vision in which, in short, Persephone came and kept calling me Ariadne. And I was saying, no, my name is Carla, which was like Ariadne. And then I couldn't get out of that vision without repeatedly telling myself, my name is Carla, my name is Carla, my name is Carla. So I had this, it's a couple of years ago, it was very, and probably the most intense vision I ever had. So,
No.
but then a lot of people call themselves Ariadne. And so I, again, you know, my cerebral brain hesitates because it goes, well, how could you have been Ariadne when there's 500,000 people that also claim that they're connected to Ariadne in some way, or she comes to them? My logical brain goes, no, it's only a one person if she was a human, but of course she may have been mostly a goddess. You might know that better than me. So, and so I think that's when I started paying a little more attention to Dionysus. And then, so, but so the only other, so he's the only one that really knocks on my door a lot. And then sometimes Hecate lately. Yeah, but that's a triad. I can accept that because Hecate, Selene, Artemis, right? So I'm like, oh, this feels good. This feels right, a trinity. But I'm starting to feel like my trinity is going to be Hecate, Dionysus, and Artemis in a way. Like it feels like these three are.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So what do you, when you think of him in Crete then? So thinking of him in the classical period, for example, like you said, oh, and if you don't mind expanding a bit on the god that he synchronized with as well.
I am not actually that familiar with Sabazios, except that he is a sort of bog standard ecstatic deity. That's classical era, and the Bronze Age is really my specialty. So
Okay, no, that's great because I would like to do an episode on Dionysus. It just feels a bit overwhelming because he's just so multifaceted in so many ways. And I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to do 3 hours, but maybe I'll look that up. But what do you think about Crete and the Bronze Era? What do you think his role was there, or what do you know his role was there?
okay, so we have a combination of academic research and shared gnosis, and I will do my best to tease those two apart, but they interweave pretty significantly. First of all, the your visions with the bull, Dionysus was not actually connected with the bull until the early Iron Age. And I have a theory about why that was. Okay, so I talked about things shifting and changing over time, like from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age. Things shifted during the Bronze Age as well. Okay, so the early to middle Bronze Age is what we think of as really the glory of Minoan civilization, right? It's the shiny palaces, which are actually temples, and the frescoes, the beautiful art, the incredible wealth, most of which we don't have anymore because it was probably stolen, melted down. But so that's, that's several centuries, close to I guess that's about 1,000 years, from maybe 3,000 to maybe 2,000 BCE, or maybe a little later than that. And then by 1600 BCE, you have the infamous Thera eruption, right? That just absolutely devastates the entire Eastern Mediterranean. And contrary to popular belief, that did not actually destroy the Minoans. It was a major blow to the entire Eastern Mediterranean, not just to Crete, but to the coast of Greece and Anatolia, the Levant, Egypt. The whole area was just scoured by a tsunami and overwhelmed by the ash cloud, and it was a mess for a number of years. And the Minoans had been very wealthy, very powerful. They were like the Switzerland of their day, right? They traded with everybody. They had all the money. And suddenly they didn't anymore. The entire northern and eastern coast of the island was just scrubbed down to the ground. The destruction layer in the excavations is really just heartrending, just to see where it was all just crushed by the tsunami. And so they rebuilt. It was very hard for a while. It's clear from the remains. It was very hard for a while, but they rebuilt. But that devastation weakened them enough that they needed outside help. And it looks like the Mycenaeans took advantage of the situation. They were the Minoans were interested in trade. Their conquest was purely economic, right? They wanted to trade with everyone. The Mycenaeans were interested in classical land conquest, territory conquest. And over the next couple hundred years, they managed to take over and occupy Knossos, which was the biggest city on the island. They managed to also take over the north-south corridor across those beautiful mountains down to Festos and the cities in that area. And it looks like they also took over the cities to the west, like Chania and Telissos. They were unable to take over the cities to the east. There was resistance. There
Interesting.
was significant native resistance. And so those last couple hundred years, that's when we have a lot of artifacts from. Almost all the frescoes from the Knossos Temple are from the Mycenaean occupation era.
Interesting.
Yes, 600 to 1400, 1300 BCE. So an awful lot of what we think of as purely Minoan isn't. It's actually a Mycenaean Minoan blend at that point. And we have teased out, we've been at this for 10 years now in Ariadne's tribe. So we have teased out what we think are the details of what happened to the pantheon and the mythos during that era. The Mycenaeans were an Indo-European people, right? They're the ancestors of the modern Greeks. And the Indo-Europeans have, all the Indo-European cultures have a pantheon structure that is headed by male gods, usually a sky god at the top. And the Minoan pantheon structure and the structure of many of the other pantheons around the Eastern European before the Indo-Europeans came in was not typically male dominated. They may the Minoan one appears to have been headed by mother goddesses, which makes sense because a pantheon is typically reflective of the culture, right? The structure of the pantheon reflects the structure of the culture. And if the Minoans were as we believe, a matrilineal culture, then it would make sense for goddesses to be sort of the head of the family in a pantheon. And so the Mycenaeans borrowed a lot of Minoan religion. They borrowed iconography, they borrowed double handfuls of deities into their own religious practice. And in that borrowing, they shifted things around to fit their setup better, right? Because they already had a structure for the way their pantheon worked. And And they also did what the Greeks and the Romans did later, which was equate local deities with theirs, right? So just like you have Sulis Minerva in Iron Age Britain, they looked at the Minoan pantheon, and for some reason they picked Dionysus as their preferred male deity. We don't know why. There are plenty of other male deities, but they decided they liked him best, and so they equated him. They decided he should be the top of the pantheon,
Interesting.
and they called him Cretan Zeus.
No.
Yes. Okay. And so you will see him referred to in some of the early classical writings as Cretan Zeus. So when you go to Crete and you hear people talking about Zeus being born in a cave there, it's
They're in that cave.
Dionysus.
Wow. That cave is now closed for a few years. They're fixing it, right? That's the one. But I've been in that cave a couple of years ago. Yeah, you're right.
So Dionysus, among other things, is the divine child born to the great mother in a cave at midwinter, surrounded by
Connections
friendly
are
animals, surrounded by friendly animals, right? Because the goat goddess Amalthea is there
Yeah.
and feeds the baby on her milk. And so yeah, he is the divine child born at midwinter, at least in late Minoan times. We have reconstructed, you were talking about trios and triplicities, right? There are lots of threes all over the place in the Minoan pantheon. And one of the triplicities is the goddesses, the mother goddesses who head the pantheon. They represent the realms of land, sky, and sea.
Makes
So
sense.
we have the earth goddess Rhea and the sun goddess. We call her Tarasia. We don't know what the Minoans called her. And the sea goddess Posidaia, whose name is attested in the Linear B tablets. And we have a triplicity of sons and a triplicity of daughters that go with them.
Okay. Wow.
And so the daughters, you might be interested to know, Rhea's daughter is Ariadne.
Okay.
Tarasia's daughter is Arachne.
Wow.
And Posidaia's daughter is Anthea, who is an early face of Aphrodite.
Wow.
And then the sons, Rhea's son is Tauros Asterion, who is the bull god, right? The earthly and starry bull. Tarasia's son is Korydallos. That's the Greek word for the bird, the lark. We discovered him through dance ethnology. He still exists in folk dances around the Eastern Mediterranean today. He's called the Red Champion.
Interesting.
We don't know what the Minoans called him, but we call him Korydallos. He seems to like that name. He's a bit of a trickster, and so his name is also a joke because in English, a lark can also mean a sort of a joke or a pun or play on words.
Yeah.
And then Posidaia's son is Dionysus. Because if you will recall, in some of his earliest myths, he's connected with the sea, right? The dolphin is one of his symbolic animals.
Yes.
And sailors who died at sea their souls were thought to take the form of dolphins, and dive down into the deep ocean, which would be a passageway to the underworld.
Isn't it fascinating that later Greeks turned that story into a horror story in which
Yes.
Dionysus turns the sailors into dolphins as punishment?
Yeah.
Not surprising,
Mean,
but interesting.
that may have been the best they could do with, the garbled fragments of the myth that made it through the LBA collapse, because Heaven knows, oral tradition, in a stable culture, oral tradition is really remarkably accurate from one generation to another because people teach it to each other and are very particular about it being memorized exactly. But once you have chaos and collapse, then that just goes out the window. But yeah, so he's Dionysus is the son of Grandmother Ocean.
Wow. And there are so many dolphin riders. That's another thing I've noticed more and more in artifacts. So many dolphin riders that were or that continue to be in the culture now. The timing is all over the place for some of these artifacts. And so obviously they're based on sort of mythology and then repeated and recycled and things like that. But I have seen the idea of dolphin riders or kids playing on dolphins also in sort of Minoan Mycenaean culture. That's something that you have seen as well.
No, actually, someone asked me about that the other day, so I went looking. I cannot find any depictions of humans and dolphins in the sea together in either Minoan or Mycenaean art.
Huh. I wonder if that's a later. I haven't followed that thread, like other than the artifacts, which basically just say Dolphin Rider, Greece, this date. I had always assumed they are somehow either connected to Poseidon or Dionysus, but never followed that thread either. So I wonder what's behind, if there is anything that we can trace it back to, sort of an original inspiration for this.
Well, my thought is that could be a symbolic depiction of the human soul, the spirit of the deceased. Maybe at some point somebody thought, oh, they don't turn into dolphins. Maybe the dolphins are the sort of animal conveyance that carries the soul to the depths, because the depths of the ocean are considered to be a doorway to the underworld, just like caves are.
That's fascinating. And so the Trinity, then, the Trinities seem to be embedded within Minoan culture, which is actually quite fascinating. Trinities feel very natural to me, but again, like I said, I can't tell if that's because I was raised Catholic
Yeah.
or Christian, or it's a combination amalgamation of all those things, because maybe trinities are something that collectively, unconsciously, something that we deeply, intuitively know. Why? I don't know. But I find that fascinating that there's this re repetition of trinities in Crete. And so if you were to, what would be some of the, okay, so now, okay, wait, I have too many questions. Okay, so the first one then is, at which point do you think that Dionysus and Asterion, okay, we've talked about before how Asterion becomes a monster, and that's definitely sort of Athenian conquest over Crete,
Right.
right? So it's, I call it like fiction. I started to use the word fiction because I think people understand fiction better rather than this is not academically, or so, academics kind of made this up, or this is biased, or this is all of those words fit. But I think sometimes I just say, well, this is like Ovid. Now I'm starting to just say, well, Ovid is just fan fiction.
Yes.
Right? Because I mean,
Yes.
that's what it is. And I think people get it right away when you say fan fiction. Rather than going into the whole, I mean, I guess if we did a whole episode on Ovid, we could talk about all the political propaganda he's creating. So sometimes I think we can use that word for some of what the Greeks did, or certainly the Athenians with the Minotaur, created this fiction of this monster, which is Asterion.
Right.
But where do you think these two, the symbol of the bull, and because Minoans were bull riders and athletes. And yet Dionysus is in the water, let's say, with the dolphins. So at which point do you think, and again, I mean, you don't have to know this, but do you think these two kind of overlapped?
Yeah, I'm guessing the original sort of collision happened during the Mycenaean occupation. Because by all rights, being Rhea's son, the Earth Mother's son, Tauros Asterion should be the divine child born in the cave, right?
True.
Because it's Rhea's cave.
Yeah.
And so it is our theory at this point, our educated guess, that because the Mycenaeans, for whatever reason, chose Dionysus as the most important of the Minoan gods, that they put him in that position. They substituted him and he became the divine child. So, you know, during those last couple centuries.
Right. It's now that you say Crete and Zeus, it's so fascinating to me because I remember going up to that cave, which I don't know if you've been, but it takes so long to get up there. You know, people are taking the donkeys up there. It is a hike, right?
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, why am I doing this for Zeus? Like, I don't care about Zeus. But I was like, okay, let's just go and see this dang cave, you know? And being in that cave and thinking to myself, like, I don't know, this doesn't feel like Zeus. But I had not thought about Dionysus, which now that you say, now they've, like I said, they've closed it, they're fixing it up. But I'm very excited for when they open it up again to go into it with sort of this new knowledge. And it makes sense, I think, because again, what is Zeus doing in Crete, right? I think that's a question lots of people bring up, you know, this idea of why is, you know, of course he's supposed to be there to run away from Kronos, but yeah.
And you know, there are at least two caves that are identified as Rhea's sacred cave. There's the one on, there's Silaritis, the one on, and there's, so there's Mount Dicte and Mount Ida, those
yes.
two. So those, the sacred caves on both of those
yes.
are considered to be Rhea's sacred cave. And we're, there are many other identified sacred caves connected with other deities, but those two in particular are supposed to be hers. And I have to wonder if there wasn't some kind of competition in the Minoan era. No, we've got the real one. No, we've got the real one.
Yes, I haven't climbed up to Mount Ida. That's where they say they have that hole in the ground, or what are they called? The cavern in the ground. I don't know if they say it was an ancient Minoan place of worship. And no. That no, I'm lying. That's Mount Yukta. Mount
Yes,
Yukta.
yes.
Sorry,
Yukta
I'm
says,
lying. Mount Yukta. I don't think I've climbed Mount Ida anyways. Sometimes I climb mountains for different reasons, and now I don't look at where I'm really going sometimes. But Mount Yukta is the one I'm talking about, which has the cavern in the ground. And that I was supposed to climb when I went there last time, but I just got a little bit lazy and didn't. But Rhea, I did know that Rhea played a key role in Crete. And again, absorbed later into Greek pantheon as sort of, you know, this Titan goddess. But I love the idea that she's the Earth Mother. You know.
I mean, if you look at the Greek pantheon, the stratification is pretty clear because you have the Olympians and the Titans.
Yeah.
And so the Titans are the deities who were already there when the Indo-Europeans arrived. That's the cultural stratification. And some of them are ones who were borrowed from Crete, and some of them were borrowed from the mainland Greeks who were there before the Indo-Europeans arrived. And we've been able to draw parallels. Okay, let me back up a second here. So I start tumbling forward and I'm like, wait a minute, we need some background. Let me provide some context.
Okay.
So, in the Neolithic, like 10,000 BCE, we have the advent of agriculture, right? And, in Anatolia, in the area that is modern day, central and western Turkey, there was a significant population that over the course of several centuries, took up farming. And then there was a population explosion and people started migrating out of that area looking for space. And so there were a number of different waves of migration, and this has all been verified by DNA research. So we can actually trace where people went and when. And so one of those waves came out of Anatolia and went down into mainland Greece. Another one of those waves came out of Anatolia and down the Aegean and ended up in Crete.
Okay, makes sense.
So the people who were there in mainland Greece when the Mycenaeans arrived were cousins, I guess you could say, of the people in Crete who became the Minoans. And so their pantheons are similar because they came from the same originating culture. And so we can actually draw parallels between some of the pre-Indo-European deities in the Hellenic pantheon and the Minoan pantheon.
And that also explains why in Anatolia and modern day Turkey, there's so many ancient, for example, caves to Demeter. And of course, Kybele was one, but to Demeter and Hecate, which again, it's hard to know whether these are Greek names or they're related to, or they were labeled, these goddesses were primordial and then were labeled with Greek names. But what I mean, the worship patterns and their sort of characteristics seem to be overlapping in that area. So I think, yeah, that explains all of that Neolithic history or inspiration or practice, really, that was kind of hijacked.
I mean, I do my best not to sort of mentally paint one culture as the bad guys and another culture as the good guys, because that's sort of not fair, because we're all just human.
True.
But there is now some DNA evidence that suggests that the waves of Indo-Europeans who came into Europe were not truly representative of Indo-European society. That Indo-European society, while being patriarchal, was perhaps not as extreme as we ended up with in Europe. And the DNA evidence suggests that it was groups of young males who either left or possibly were driven out of the Indo-European homeland and moved into Europe. And so they were maybe not the best representation of their culture.
Yes, and that makes sense. And I think that really lines up also with Gimbutas' work, which is now becoming more and more verified as if we didn't already know. Because perhaps in her interpretation that these were all sort of male groups or male whatever. Now this may be a scientific, whatever academic explanation for why there were so many of these male groups, let's call them, that were suddenly starting to move around and were kind of hostile in some way and were looking actually to settle because they also didn't have anywhere to settle in a way either.
And this is a distinction from the waves of migration that came out of Neolithic Anatolia, because those were families, right? Those were families and sometimes whole communities that migrated together. They even brought all their farm animals with them. That has been verified with DNA. So they actually brought all their farm animals with them. But the Indo-Europeans, it was essentially men on horseback. And that was it. So that's like Miriam Robbins Dexter has done a lot of deep research into the goddesses of the Indo-European base culture. And there are a lot of them, but they never made it into Europe because the dudes on horseback only brought their gods with them, because that's who they personally worshipped. And so that is perhaps why we end up with so many pre-Indo-European goddesses borrowed into, for instance, the Hellenic pantheon, because there were empty spaces to fill.
And when you say that, it reminds me when I was in Thebes, they have this massive collection of artifacts, but particularly frescoes from the Mycenaeans. and other pieces. But one of the things that you see repeatedly are horses, men and horses, men and horses.
Yes.
So what you're saying actually fills, so there in some way you see the Minoan influence or the Minoan contribution, let's say, because you see the dolphins and the women and the there's a lot of that. But then they have like sort of entire plaques that are 20 men on horses and a one guy in front. And, you know, so lots of men and horses. In fact, I think one of the things I said to my friend was like, it is very clear the Mycenaeans love their horses and their men. But as you say that, I'm thinking, yeah, that makes a lot of sense that you could almost see this shift in their art, the what they valued in their art. And men on horses started to be, I guess, more and more of a focal point in some of their work. And in their artifacts that they made, the ceramics that they made, little horses, you know, we find all these horses,
Right.
right?
Yeah, there weren't any horses on Crete until the Mycenaean occupation.
Oh.
They did not exist.
Interesting.
They used oxen and goats to pull wagons and carts, but there were no horses.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and so if you see a horse in Minoan art, you know it's from the Mycenaean occupation or later.
That's fascinating. Okay, I didn't know that. Yeah, that's really interesting. I've started to pay a little more attention. So, you know, I've gone to the Heraklion Museum several times. You know, you always go with an intention. And now I'm starting to pay a little more attention to more nuances of different aspects
Right.
based on a lot of the stuff that you've posted in the group, because I think, you know, some things you learn as you're digging through research during the Minoans, you know, from articles. But the way to appreciate, let's say, a fresco or to appreciate a piece or an axe, for example, or whatever, a butterfly or whatever it is on the art that seems to be so symbolically Minoan. After a while, I think you start to appreciate those in a different form, in a different way than maybe when you initially see them, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about? So, okay, my favorite cave in Crete is the Scotino cave. Has anything come up for you guys? So I say this because I feel like, okay, so let me tell you before you tell me, in case you tell me something and then I go, oh, like, okay. So it's my favorite cave. I don't know why. I originally went there because there was a Brit-Omartis Martis story there and perhaps an Artemis story there and all this stuff. And then it had such a powerful it has such a powerful power in there. Although people like other caves, there's lots of caves in Crete. People have different favorites. And I started going there, perhaps before my divorce, yeah, and started making offerings in this cave to a goddess that seems to me, okay, it seems to me sort of like a dark goddess, but I'm not using the word dark in a negative way, but something primordial, something deep, something, I don't know. That cave has power. So now it's come to a place where every time I go to Crete, I go and leave an offering in this cave, usually of sweets, honey, because who doesn't, you know, the gods, right? They all like their honey sweets or pastries. So, okay, so that's my interpretation of this cave. And there have been some moments of vision and communication in this cave, which is, again, I get in the car and I go, is that a real thing? Did that really happen? You know? But I've made a commitment to every time I'm in Crete, I show up and I make an offering of thanks. So I don't know. And again, I don't want you, I'm not saying you're an expert in every cave in Crete. I'm just wondering if there's anything you've heard or in the group, anyone that's had feelings at this cave as well.
So far, we associate that one with Brito Martis, who is okay. So, context again. Jeez. Okay. So here's another set of triplicities. We have horned deities, right? We call them the horned ones, and then there are three pairs. They're male female pairs. These are not husband wife in as you would find in like the Hellenic era. These are just male female pairs. We have cattle horned ones, goat horned ones, and deer horned ones.
Okay.
Okay. So the cattle horned ones are the Minotaur and Europa.
Makes sense.
Okay. The goat horned ones are, we call him the Minocapros or Vicaro and Amalthea.
Wow. Okay.
And the deer horned ones are Divano and Brito Martis.
Wow.
Okay. Each of the three male horned ones is a face of one of those three sons, Taurus Asterion, Corydalos, and Dionysus. Divano, the male deer horned one, is a face of Dionysus.
I knew you were going to say that. Okay. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And his female counterpart, you might think of her as his sister, is Brito Martis. And she is very much, now, if you look at these three pairs, if you look at the animals that they are connected with, so cattle are fully domesticated livestock, right?
Mm-hmm.
Goats kind of straddle that domesticated and wild line, right? They're kind mm-hmm. of liminal creatures anyway.
Yeah.
So like even today on Crete, there are both domesticated goats and feral ones.
Right.
Right. And deer are completely wild. They have not been domesticated.
Yeah.
And so Divono and Brito Martis are completely wild. Okay. They are not domesticated. They're not confined or constricted by culture
mm-hmm.
or civilization.
Mm-hmm.
They are life, material life embodied, the cycles of wild nature. Brito Martis is often referred to as the huntress, which points to the era before agriculture, mm-hmm. right? So this is foraging culture, what used to be called hunter-gatherers. And if you look at indigenous cultures, especially in Eurasia, but pretty much anywhere around the world, hunting is its own special sacred act.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, it's not just getting food. Foraging comes closer to just, you know, getting food.
Agreed, agreed.
Something closer to going to the grocery store. But hunting is a special sacred act that involves a relationship with the spirit of the animal you're hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, in the fragments of myth that survived about Brito Martis and her activities, she is the huntress and Divano is the hunted.
Really?
Huh. And the idea is that he sacrifices himself in order to provide sustenance.
Hmm.
And that is a maybe, I don't know if the word archetype is what I'm going for here, but that is a symbolic concept that you see repeatedly. Gee, I can't think of any modern monotheistic deity who sacrifices himself in order to sustain his worshipers. But yeah, so that it's that concept. But it's the goddess who does the sacrificing, who performs the sacrifice. And so anyone in a post-Bronze Age era is probably going to find that energy to be really dark and somewhat disturbing, because that is really not something we do anymore.
Yeah. You know, one of the things, and I've had, I think I did one or two lectures on this where I talked about, and I posed the question though, I don't know that anyone's ready to talk about the fact that we no longer offer God sacrifices in the same way. We no longer offer blood sacrifices. We don't always offer, in this case, an animal sacrifice that is brought to a place, particularly to be killed in honor of this god. And by us, I mean mostly in the West and in the areas where this has been, like modern day Greece or
Right.
and people, and I don't know how I feel. So somebody had said to me, I was on a podcast, and somebody had said to me, you know, you should try hunting since you really Artemis is your divinity. And I cannot bring my, I mean, let's be honest. I obviously, if I had to feed myself and my children, I would hunt. So I'm not opposed to it. But as an experience, even as a sacred experience, I cannot yet bring myself to do it. So I want to put that there before I say that. I do wonder whether the God, sometimes, you know, when you're driving in your car and you're in Canada and it takes an hour to get to work and an hour to get home, I ask myself, do the gods miss, you know, a blood sacrifice, a hunting sacrifice? How do we, what have we replaced in our practice that might be acceptable to the divine who for 10,000 years or less, more or less, ate and drank and, you know, I mean, I'm offering honey and sugar, obviously. I'm not offering wine because you never know about wine and alcohol, right? Some Chthonic gods and goddesses are not fans of alcohol, or so the Hellenics tell us. But there are times when I'm like, you know, I don't know. Does this qualify as enough, I guess? And again, this is just opinion based because obviously we don't know. There's no one to really interview and say, hey, Artemis, what do you think? what do you know, what sort of has come up for you guys and when you're practicing? Because you are, I think you are the closest group, at least that I know, but also that is connecting to Minoan culture in the modern world in a way that is, you know, really meaningful and gather and communal.
Well, consider that in Minoan times and even in the Hellenic era, when someone wanted meat for dinner, they literally went out and found, either hunted the animal or got it from the farmstead and slaughtered it as part of the food preparation process. This was perfectly normal. And in much of the world today, outside of highly industrialized Western society, it is still the case.
Sure.
And in fact, it was the case on the small family farm that I grew up on. You want chicken for dinner? Which one of the chickens out in the chicken yard is not laying anymore? That's the one we're going to have for dinner. So it's not so much, to me anyway, it's not so much the concept of the blood sacrifice as the concept of giving your food and having the process of the food from the very beginning to the very end be given, be dedicated to the deity. And we don't slaughter our own animals, most of us anymore. The sacrifice that we make is when we put our dollars down on the counter at the supermarket.
Yeah, exactly. Which is a sacrifice still. I mean,
Yes.
yes, many of us work very hard for those dollars. So yes, absolutely.
And the spilling of the blood happens at the slaughterhouse now. And so yeah, we have had mixed results with this kind of thing in Ariadne's tribe in our actual spiritual practice. A few of the deities that we have approached with the possibility of actually like hunting or otherwise slaughtering an animal in their for a sacrifice to them have said essentially not, oh, how dare you do that, but rather you're asking the wrong question. So it's like it's not the blood itself. It's not the substance. There's something else behind it that is, because when you speaking as someone who grew up on a small family farm where there was very little margin for error, when you slaughter an animal, it's gone. Okay, it can no longer breed to increase your stock. It can no longer be sold. So you are taking a, especially if it's a large animal like a goat or a cow, you are taking a substantial portion of your family's wealth and cutting it apart and eating it. And so, dedicating the act of removing the animal from the herd permanently to the deities is almost literally the equivalent of pulling a huge wad of cash out of your pocket and setting fire to it.
Right. I see what you mean.
And so there is energetic stuff associated with blood that can be used for magic and various other purposes. But if you're just talking about food, if you're just talking about slaughtering an animal for food, then that specific act seems to correlate pretty effectively with buying very high quality food, or making it yourself with very high quality ingredients and then giving it as an offering.
It reminds me, I guess as you're saying that, I'm thinking that the gods in some ways evolve and adapt as we do with time as well. So that someone has said to me, well, now we are offering wine or we're offering et cetera in exchange or instead or as a symbol of. And again, I have no authority to say whether a god says yes or no. I mean, I don't know, but I can imagine that the deities are not static, in a 3,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago stance. They've come along and hope to reconnect with us in the modern. And so I think that makes a lot of sense because in the modern, whatever it is that you're offering, sacrificing, paying for, et cetera, in theory has a similar energetic value to what you might have hunted.
There's also the aspect that all of these ancient cultures had complex, as in like deeply woven tapestry, relationships with the deities that already had built-in safeguards and expectations that everybody knew on the part of both the humans and the deities. And we no longer have that context. And those are kind of like guardrails, right? That's like your safety is knowing all of this. We no longer have that. So when someone back then hauled a goat out of the pen and slit its throat and cut it up for a meal, they understood all the implications of that act and the ways in which that act would tie them to various deities, obligate them to the deities, obligate the deities to them. And we don't have any of that context anymore. We literally have none of it. And so, if you've got a flock of chickens out back and you decide that you want to sacrifice a chicken to one of your deities, you don't know what the context for that act is. You don't. Besides, outside of your own desire to show your dedication, you don't know what that act will do. You don't know what the consequences are. And blood especially has an amount of power to it in an energetic sense that it does stuff.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I have doctor and nurse friends who are not at all pagan or spiritual in this regard, and they will tell you that blood does stuff,
Yeah.
energetically, magically. They may not use those words, but that's what they mean. And so if you don't have a fully developed understanding between you and a deity of exactly what's going to go on if you spill blood for that deity, then you have no control over the outcome in your life and the lives of the people around you. So,
Wow. That's, yes, Laura, that's really powerful, actually. You're absolutely right. And that might answer a little bit, that perspective might answer also my idea in the sense that I don't feel, despite the fact that I worship a huntress, I don't feel called to kill something in her name. And so, you know what I mean? I don't have that pull. And in fact, when the first time I offered sweets to, let's call her Brito Martis, the vision in the cave that when she showed up was intense as heck. And the thought did cross my mind, actually, just as you say, you know, you're calling someone, you know, let's hope that the sugar and the honey is enough and is not too intense, you know. So that thought did cross my mind because, again, I think we maybe in our modern world today, we may not take some of that stuff as seriously, or maybe we don't talk about it enough in the public sphere about if you want to worship a deity, especially around Hecate. Like, I have this video on TikTok that blew up from Hecate Lagina because I went to go visit the site, and there are, it just went nuts, you know. And, the comments in it are very much like, I feel pulled to this, and she's calling me, and all of this, which is fine. But sometimes a part of me goes, okay, but I hope a lot of these people are doing their homework. And also, actually, there is another TikToker or whatever who had been working with Hecate for several years. I don't know the story, but I've kind of heard secondhand stories, who now said, oh, she pulled me into a dark place, and bad things started happening to me, and now I'm no longer practicing. And the thing that crosses my mind is like, but did you do your homework? Like, did you do your research about what you're offering to any divine being and what the exchange is? Like, so maybe that, you know, maybe that's something that I need to more publicly speak about. When something goes nuts like that, I don't comment anymore. But there was a lot of like, how should I worship? What should I do? This place has been in my dreams, so I should, you know, start with Hecate. And I think, you know, perhaps as we move forward into more goddess worship and more the phenomenon is growing, this may be a conversation that we'll need to have repeatedly about how to do your homework before making an offering, and
Right.
especially, like you say, a blood offering or a sacrifice or a hunt or something that could have intense consequences.
Right. Right. I mean, any offering that you make connects you with a deity, right? And so that's a development of that relationship. Yeah, it's and then there's research, and then there's listening to the deity, which is something that a lot of people, unless you intuitively know how to do it, it can be difficult to learn, but it's really vital. Some people call it the God phone. Gotta listen to the God phone. And because if you're going to be in relationship with a deity, you have to be able to hear them.
And you know, this brings me back to Dionysus in a way, because I think part of it was that I know this divinity is very intense, or at least to me. And I was a little hesitant to, like, even accept, let's say, 3 4 days of him messing with me, because of this whole situation. It's like, I don't know enough, you know, I'm making no offerings, but I'm still walking around the museum going, I see you. I see what you're doing. I know what you're doing. So it could be quite intense. It could be quite intense, I think. What do you think about how people experience all of these things? So you must hear these stories about Crete and Minoan things all the time. Do you think, okay, so one of my theories is that maybe there's a bunch of us from that island that have somehow become gone into diaspora, descendants, whether it's spiritual descendants, that is like soul descendants, you know, or literal descendants, DNA descendants. What do you think about how many people feel pulled to the small island, you know, Crete? I mean, it's not small, but worldwide, it's quite small. And yet people have this magnetic draw to the physical island and to the Minoans as well. Well, what do you think drives that? What do you think?
Well, an awful lot of the people in Ariadne's tribe have commented that they feel like they have past life memories from Crete. That's very common. And yeah. I'm one of those. It seems like a lot of people, but you have to remember, first of all, at the height of Minoan civilization, archaeologists now think the island of Crete was at least as heavily populated as it is now, and maybe more so.
Okay.
Given how close together a lot of the Minoan settlements that they keep finding are. And that was just in one snapshot of the era, right? Mm-hmm. People lived on Crete from 10,000 BCE forward.
Yeah.
That's a lot of generations of people. So if you add all of those up, and what we think of as Minoan lasted for 1700 years, that's a lot of generations.
Yeah, that's true.
And so that many people, you know, out of all of those generations of, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of people, then it doesn't look so out of scale.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. I think because sometimes I'm so in the world, right? And when I'm in Crete, and then there's all these goddess trips and retreats, and there's lots of women that feel pulled. So sometimes maybe it feels to me like, oh my God, everyone I know is from Crete, which would be wonderful, to be honest. Sort of like I sometimes say that the island is calling us back. Like I sometimes feel like the island or Crete or whatever is sort of, if it's a central focus point and there's sort of these lights that come from it, you know, all around the world, and it's sort of echoing and pulsing. Sometimes I have these visions that the island, the space is like reaching out. I met a Cretan woman who had left in her 20s. She said, Carla, like I couldn't live here anymore with the patriarchy and the Greek Orthodoxy and blah, blah, blah. And now she was in her 40s and we had lunch, and she said, but then a couple of years ago, I was like, the island was like waking me up in the middle of the night, telling me to come home. Wow. And now I'm home, and I've got, you know, she had lived all over the world and was very spiritual and very goddess centered. And she's like, and now I have all of this, and I'm bringing it back, trying to figure out what does the island want from me? You know, what's the call? And that really sparked this idea. I was like, maybe she's calling everyone home, because I also feel like moving there, even though the practical part of me dreads it, because it's so hard, so complicated, and still quite misogynistic. And right. And a part of me is like, I don't know if you saw, I posted something where I was in the museum and I was looking at that, you know, the classic fresco with the bull riding person. And I was talking to a woman in the museum, telling her, you know, that the males were represented in a darker skin tone and the women in lighter. And therefore, we know that everyone was bull riding. Anyway, just having a casual conversation. And this man comes up to me and goes, like, kind of shoves me a little bit over and goes, do you want me to tell you about this fresco? I can tell you all about this fresco. I know all about it. And I said, no, thank you, whatever. And then he had this whole group that came within, 30 seconds. I guess he was a tour guide. And he was telling that story about, well, it's because the men went outside and so they were darker skin and the women stayed inside. And the woman that I was just talking to looked at me and I looked at her like I had just finished telling her the complete opposite of that. And I was so infuriated that I decided, I had to walk away because, as you know, I mean, you can't get into a fight.
Right.
You can't. Anyways, that's a long way of saying that there's a part of me that goes, oh man, living there will have its challenges. But then there's a part of me that goes, but no, there's nowhere else I want to live. So maybe the island is calling to some of us, because I know there's a lot of people who can't come. So they echo that from diaspora.
Well, it also occurs to me, and this is something that Maria Gimbutas pointed out, that Crete is was one of the last strongholds of old European civilization. The Minoans maintained Neolithic religious practices into the Bronze Age. Okay, and so there is a sense in which Minoan culture is an island that sticks up above sea level. And what's beneath the sea is all of that old European culture, right? So Minoan Crete may feel familiar to an awful lot of people who don't have any direct connection with Crete itself because they do have a connection with old Europe. And old Europe extends all the way over into Ukraine. I have part of my spiritual practice is ancestral reverence and my ancestral stream includes people from the Kukulcani culture, which is an old European culture located in Ukraine. So, yeah, maybe this is not just Crete. Maybe the Minoan culture is sort of a beacon to call people back to the old European that sort of Neolithic era when
Like I love this, and I know that people that are listening to us are gonna go like, wow, like yeah. So I feel like that is a truth. So I went back to Romania where I'm from. My father was raised in the Carpathians, and Cucuteni culture blends over in some part of Romania as well.
Yeah.
And I hadn't gone back for many, many years. And I said to my mother, I'm gonna go back to my roots and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, I went to go stay with family, and I was expecting something like Crete there. And I didn't feel very much, I didn't feel anything. Although I love the country and I went out and looked at a lot of Neolithic and Paleolithic artifacts because everything else is very Roman and the Dacians were very, very masculine and very aggressive and at least in what the way it's being depicted in the museums. And so I said to my mother, I go, I don't know why I don't feel like home here the way I feel when I land in Crete. Like I should, I want to, I was expecting it. And my mother says to me, oh, the re one of the reasons why we escaped when we were young and we were willing to escape is I didn't really feel that connection there. As I didn't feel like Romanian nationalist, I felt more like European nationalist, let's say. I had to move, and I had this idea. I was like, well, what if somewhere up my, down further up the DNA, maybe, we have ancestors that came out of, well, my mother has ancestors from Greek and Italian background, as many Romanians do. And so I thought maybe they came over or there's this thing, but, and maybe I'm feeling more connected to that because maybe they came over in some way, which is still a possibility. But I think this idea that you're about old Europe maybe fits even better with the resonance for that island more than, let's say, Bucharest. Or places like that.
Well, because that culture and those values survive for so much longer on Crete, so that energy is more vibrant and stronger and easier to connect with.
Well, you have given me and us so much to think about. I'm like so appreciative of your time and your explanation, and your perspective. Wow. So I thought that we would maybe even touch before we go on your work. So you said you have a few things coming up. Would you like to, yeah, let me, what are they?
Okay.
Tell us where we can get all your stuff. Tell us. Oh, and your tarot cards, because I absolutely love your tarot card readings every week. I think they're very cool. So
I can flash that right here because I've got it.
yes.
This is the book. I can't reach the deck from where I am right now, but it's the
Yes.
Minoan Tarot. This is a it's a tarot deck that I made years ago because I wanted a Minoan Tarot deck and there wasn't one at that time. And the it has gender balanced face cards. And the art is entirely Minoan. I looked at each tarot card and I thought, okay, if I were a Minoan artist trying to depict the concepts that this card represents, how would I do it? And so there is no Christian symbolism in it. There's no modern symbolism at all. Everything on it comes from Minoan Crete.
I love that. I have it. I mean, now I'm traveling, so I don't have it on me, but I bought the, it's beautiful.
Oh,
It's
thank you.
beautiful. I mean, it's such a fantastic work. It's one of my favorite decks. I mean, I don't have too many decks, but this one is one of my favorites. Yeah, I love the art. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Now that you said that, I thought, yeah, you're right. The symbols are very refreshingly Minoan. Very refreshingly Minoan. Yes. And what about the books that are coming up?
Okay, so I've got two books coming out this year. One is in the Moon Books Pantheons series, which I'm very excited about. It is called Pantheon, the Minoans, as you might expect. It is already available for pre-order. The release date is August 26, I think, and it is a it's essentially a compilation of everything that we have put together over the past decade in Ariadne's tribe about Minoan religion and the pantheon, the sacred calendar that we have created for the modern world based on our research, all the deities. Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting. I'll put the links in the description below, but that's exciting. What a reference, like what a reference book for. I can't think of anything quite like that available. So that's very, very
Yeah,
unique.
there's pretty much not anything like that except for my other two books. But anyway, and then I also have a book of modern Minoan myths coming out at Midsummer. And I had someone ask me the other day, what are modern Minoan myths? Because obviously, you know, it's because the Minoans are not modern, but we are.
Right.
And we don't have the myths from the Minoans' mouths themselves, right? Like we have the ancient Greek myths because the Greek writers, the Hellenic writers, their writings survived. The Minoans didn't. And so we've had to take all the kind of research that we were just talking about and put that together into stories that are meaningful for us today in our relationship with these deities. And a lot of the stories kind of weave into the sacred calendar. And so, and they represent like the sailing culture in Crete. There were and still are multiple subcultures on Crete, the sailors, the farmers, and the goat herders. And all three of those subcultures still exist.
That's true.
And so we've even got there is a consensus now that there was a Minoan precursor to the Eleusinian mysteries. And so we have worked up a series of myths for we're just calling them the mysteries. And that is instead of Demeter and Persephone, it's Rhea and Ariadne.
I love that. Yes.
So, and it's fully illustrated.
Oh, wow.
Books. What was it? Was it Alice in Wonderland who said, "What good is a book without pictures?"
I think so. Yeah.
I grew up on reading like the Dolores mythology books with the glorious illustrations in them, and I wanted something that had that vibe to it.
Yeah.
So I am doing a full-page color illustration for each myth, and I have started sharing those on my Substack every now and then if people want to peek at what's coming up in that, and that will be out at Midsummer.
That's beautiful. Oh, I look forward to both of those books. Wow. I mean, I'm a visual learner, but also I really enjoy visuals. One of the reasons why I go to museums and photograph 5,000 artifacts over and over and over again is because I think we need the visuals. They don't tell us
Right.
how many sitting goddesses or throne goddesses or whatever goddesses are there. And I'm like, I think by the time I'm done, it'll be thousands. We don't even know what they have in the back because they have hundreds in the back,
Right.
right? But everywhere I go, oh, here's another throne goddess. Oh, here's another, depiction of this, and here's another, and here's another. And I think it's important that we have visual representation, away from that traditional, let's say, Hellenic and later Roman representation that is very
Yeah.
specifically the male gaze, very
Yeah.
patriarchal gaze.
Yeah, I'm just like I did with the tarot, I am using Minoan art as inspiration for these pieces. In the Minoan tarot, the colors in it are exactly the colors of the pigments that the Minoans used in their frescoes. You know, what the pigments would have looked like when they were new before they faded. For the mythology book, I have gone with a lighter, more vibrant color scheme, just because it seemed to fit with the idea of like telling stories and having fun. So,
Oh, I look forward to ordering both of those. And I'll put all of that information down below us in the description so people can follow you and purchase or pre-order the books and kind of get your work out there. I think you're one of the leading, well, you are the leading modern Minoan, let's say, expert slash specialist. I don't know, whatever word you'd like to say there, that I know. So, other people might know someone else, but sometimes when I'm in a place and I see something that is not academically in an article that might explain, even if it is, I ask myself, what would Laura Perry say about this? I wonder, what does the group say about it? Like, I tried to climb, and we're closing soon, y'all, but I tried to climb up to the new place, that the new archaeological dig that they have, the clock, the sun clock, or whatever, or the dial.
Oh, on top of the mountain, yes.
Yeah, so I know where it is. Of course, we all know where it is. And so I climbed up the one side of the mountain, hoping I could stand over it and look down. But it's great. Right at the top of the mount, right at the top where you would look down onto it, there's like these massive rocks that are unclimbable. You need.
Man.
So I ran up against them and I was really, really frustrated. Anyways, and then my brain went, well, there must be roads because they're taking the cars there, Carla. They're not all hiking, but I was trying to get around, thinking they had closed it up. And plus it's an airport space and you don't want to mess with the Greeks and their airport spaces. They take that stuff seriously. So then I came down, I was defeated, the goats and I had spent some time together. And then I found this road that kind of came around the bottom. It was a dirt road, but I knew it led to the thing. And so I try to drive up to it and I did for a while. And then there's this big fence, literally, like I could see, the green archaeology. They have these green mats that they put when they're digging. I
Right.
could see them, like I could see them, but there was a fence with a dog on it that said very fiercely, like, do not pass, do not enter. This is
Oh
being
no.
not like a Greek lock. Where you're like, okay, doom, 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 doom. This was, and so I thought, Carla, you should probably spend some time emailing somebody and getting permission to go see it rather than hopping fences. But I say that because so much is still being discovered.
Yeah. All
And
the time, all the time. A lot of people have the sense, I guess, from what's available online, mostly like on Wikipedia, that Minoan excavations are something that happened a century ago and stopped. But no, there all these sites are being found all the time.
And this sundial, and then, or I'm calling it a sundial, I don't know if that's the right thing, the right word, but then I found something in the museum, like a brick with that symbol on it itself, like it looked like it had a symbol on it. So then you started seeing it in several places, and I was like, oh my God. So I don't know, maybe the Minoans will bring us into an era of sort of accepting that the ancients had, you know, were quite progressive, were engineers, were astronomers, and, had all these fascinating knowledge, which I think people are slowly coming to.
Well, we're having to sort of peel away the social Darwinism that has been applied to our history books for so long.
And the palace, you know, the palace and the name of the palace. But we're working on it. And it's, I think more and more people are leaning into it. I've had many conversations where people are like, oh yeah, I heard that they may not have been palaces. And I'm like, you did? That's wonderful. And I've even seen some people within academia sort of publish in their social media posts things about how, you know, Evans did some things, you know, that may have been a bit more. So there's more, they're taking a bit more liberty with saying the things that are pretty much public knowledge if you look up his diary and his, you know. So who knows where this will lead us, you know, Laura. I guess this must be very, very excited for your community. The more they find out, the more, the more fascinating. And perhaps like in Buddha's, I'm thinking that the more they find out, the more your understandings and intuitions will be confirmed.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, thank you so much for being here with me again.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And who knows, like we may have to meet again. And because I still feel like there's lots to talk about when it comes to this history. But thank you so much. Thank you for joining me and for being here.
Well, thank you.
All right. See you guys next time. Thank you.